Good afternoon and welcome to Azure and the Internet of Things. My name's Bryn Lewis. I'm a self-employed contractor. I work out of Christchurch, which over the last couple of years has had some unique challenges. I've been in the industry since late 1988, and to continue the theme of the keynote, my first home computer was an Amstrad CPC 6128, and my first business computer was a 10 meg turbo AT running Windows 286. So both towers of power. I'm also finding these wireless microphones quite disconcerting. The very first ticket I went to in 1997, one of the presenters, there was a team, double team, doing a presentation, and one of the team members went for a nervous pee just before the commencement of their presentation. Unbeknownst to him, he'd left his microphone turned on, and his co-presenter thought it was very amusing to turn the volume up and listen to the passing conversations as it went on. So, I got a lot of gear. The desk is full. There's stuff everywhere. I had the 30-second crash course in the video switch and the document camera. The scope for disaster is high. Please take pity on me if it goes to shit. Oh. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. So, what are we going to cover today? I'm going to take some of Lewis Benge's presentation by accident. This presentation has been rejigged a couple of times. There's been an article, series of articles in the MSD magazine by Clem Spasters talking about a remotely controllable thermostat for your home. He went straight through my topic. So, every article he released resulted in a rewrite of mine. So this is where we got to today, and I hope you like it. It's going to be a bit of an esoteric wander through the world of data acquisition and devices. Initially, we're going to look at a general overview of the Internet of Things and then move on to the .NET micro framework. The .NET micro framework is a very cool thing, very, very cool. And my favorite toy with the .NET framework is this. It's a little robot. It's a cheap little robot. It's a great educational robot. For those of you who have a partner, it's very easy to get past the finance committee because it involves the children. There's a microcontroller board, which you can program with .NET, and a speed controller board that you can buy for 30 bucks, batteries, infrared eyes. It'll motor around, smack into the furniture, just generally great educational tool to let people play with. And this is what originally got me into the .NET micro framework. It struggles around here because of the silver chair legs. It can't see them. The infrared eye, it'll motor up to them, smack into them, and just sit there with its motor whizzing. So, after we talked a bit about the .NET micro framework, we're going to move into talking about Azure. And there's going to be a bit in there, which I'm going to have to leave out because Clem Spasters has already covered it. And then in the end, we're going to bring it together with a sort of a quite pertinent scenario, which I hope you like. And then at the end, there's going to be some summary, and I've got some swag. The guys from MindKits were kind enough to give me a robot chassis to give away for a good question. So, get your thinking caps on. So, the Internet of Things. How many of you have heard of this term? Show of hands, please. Oh, that's good, a few of you. There's been some numbers bandied around by those who are aiming to make money from it. They're expecting that there'll be 50 million devices attached to the Internet of Things by 2020. And if you look at that, that's going to be 7 devices for every person on the planet. That's going to be your toaster, your cookie, your fridge, your car. Everything will be connected to the Internet of Things, which is good and bad. It's a disruptive civil technology. According to the National Intelligence Council, there are 5 technologies which they've identified which will give America a strategic advantage. One of the other 5, which intrigued me as I was reading this white paper, was gerontology, which is how to look after old people because of the aging population. So smart grid, looking after old people, highly related. It's great for critical infrastructure. I assume that all of you here have got a bit of a green bent and you're thinking about what your next car might be. Visualise what's going to happen to a power grid when you all get home in the evening, plug your plug-in Prius in, and suddenly all that demand hits the grid in one shot. It's how do we cope with massive peaks and how do we adapt to our environment by using sensor arrays? They're talking about ambient interactions where you don't even think about the underlying technology. You eat a bottle of yogurt, you drop it into the bin, the RFID tag reader on the bin reads the tag, checks with the fridge, and then updates your countdown shopping list without you even knowing. On the topic of power grids, my kids used to watch TV NZ7, which was great. And one day I was watching it with them, and they had this program about power stations. And they had this guy sitting at a console in the British National Network Management Centre. And they were talking about load management. And my five-year-old and seven-year-old were sitting there going, oh, this is cool. And the whole scenario was managing peak load. This person was organising to purchase power from the French and having spinning reserve running in Scotland and in Wales and outside of London for coping with a sudden spike in demand. And this sudden spike in demand, they knew when it was starting because of the music for the first advert break in EastEnders. As the EastEnders music started, they started spinning up the spinning reserve. They talked to the French, purchased the necessary power, and then went forward, praying that nothing broke. And previously, they have had stuff break in that particular moment and had to shut down whole areas of the grid. One of the things that struck me as I was watching this was everyone who was about to boil their jug had a fridge. So rather than talking to the French, and rather than having some spinning reserve, why not use a smart grid to turn off their fridge for the 10 or 15 minutes while their jug boiled and massively reduce that spike? There's a lot of scope for end-to-end connectivity. It's big. Devices talking to devices and not involving humans, because humans add latency and delay. With these systems, if you've got 50 billion devices, that's a shedload of data. That's more data than you or I could ever comprehend. And this data is quite time-sensitive. My instantaneous power consumption is valuable for minutes. My instantaneous power consumption at 5 minutes past six on June the 27th is most probably not worth a lot in 6 months' time. But my power consumption for the month is worth a bit because that's how you make your bills. Security and privacy is also an issue. I work with embedded devs who specializes in building software for small devices. And they're not quite as focused on security as I am. And they go, oh, no one will ever hack it. You're right. So the problem is, hacking my house and making my lights flash on and off, it's uncool. But hacking a suburb or a city's worth of houses and making them all flash on and off simultaneously is going to destabilize the power grid, and a lot of people are going to have a very bad day. Supposedly, the Israelis took out the Iranian nuclear weapons effort by hacking their SCADA software and damaging the centrifuges. It's going to be a method of war. If there is another war, and thankfully no two fully functioning democracies or countries with McDonald's have ever gone to war, I expect that the first attack will be internet-based. Disable critical infrastructure and start with power grids, sewage, water, things which make it unpleasant. So it's also a hot topic for VCs. There's plenty of money flowing around, so if my presentation gives you some inspiration, I'd like a small cut, please. When you IPO and retire to Wanaka or to the Gold Coast, I'd like to have a badge. You can have the mansion, I'll have the badge. So these systems generate a lot of data to be aggregated and processed. So who went to the Stream Insight Prezo just before? Cool. You saw about 20 minutes of my presentation, version one. It's changed so much. So what's Microsoft's play in the small end of the space? I'm going to talk about Azure, but I'm not going to talk about writing Azure applications because that'll bore you to tears. You've been to the Prezos before. This is going to be talking about how to get stuff into Azure, and then I'm going to have four forays into demo hell with devices and a camera, which just freaks me out. So Microsoft's play into the small space is the .NET micro framework. How many of you have done any compact framework dev here? Okay, big framework, compact framework, they left a few things out. You're missing the odd overload. You go blah da 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 dot. Ah, the overload I wanted isn't there. With the micro framework, it's da 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 dot. Oh, there's only one. It's great though. It's harking back to the old days. When I first entered the industry, and one of the great things about computing is you get to do a lot of stuff. One of the first things I learned how to do was black start a hydroelectric power station. And you don't get to do that being a lawyer or an accountant. I can be a loan shark. I can be a bookie. I can black start a hydro power station. I can make Berber carpet. My background originally was process control, where failure was stinky and unpleasant and expensive. So I enjoy going back to writing code for these devices. They're tiny. It's a 32-bit ARM7 or ARM9. It doesn't require an MMU, so there's no memory management unit. There's 64K of RAM, or a quarter of a meg of flash. Woohoo. What are you going to do with all that space? It's quick. It's really quite quick, and it's quite cool to work with, but it's not a hard real operating time, real-time operating system. You're not going to use it for controlling a robot in a factory. Fine for a robot which bangs into the furniture, bad for a robot that spray paints cars. There's no JIT or NGen because that would make it all less deterministic. So realistically, it's all bytecoded. It's a bootable VM. It runs and there's no underlying operating system to bog things down. I was gobsmacked. They open sourced it in 2009. You can go and get the source and poke around in it. You can build your own device. If you had the sudden and overwhelming urge, you could get a processor, some soldering iron, and then I would most probably hurt myself at that stage, and do a board port and build a device. It's got a PAL and a HAL. There's a platform abstraction layer and a hardware abstraction layer, so it's portable across different platforms. Power consumption is low. You can aggressively sleep the processor and wake it on interrupt so that if you've got a solar-powered system or something like that, you can run for long periods. You don't pull stuff, you always wake up. It's an Apache license, so you can actually have a go at butchering it. Sorry, making a carefully considered modification to suit your environment yourself. I worked for a company where the devs thought it was a good idea to patch part of the Linux kernel to make their switching infrastructure running faster. I was inside. I was petrified because that sort of stuff requires real skill, which I don't have and I wasn't confident they had. So you've got digital inputs and outputs. You've got analog inputs. Pulse width modulation inputs. These are a way of controlling the duty cycle of the output to vary the amount of power. So that robot has three different speeds, slow, medium, and really fast. Out of control, actually, the first time I tried it. There's also the I2C bus, the inter-integrated circuit bus. And the great thing about that is it lets you connect devices like these. This can be an I/O device for your robot. Very cool. It's also got some serial peripherals, which let you talk to GPSs, RFID tag readers, and things like that. So, it's fun out of the Spotwatch. Until an hour ago, I'd never seen one of these. One of the other presenters had one. This attractive beast. You could program it, download programs to it, and it would communicate with MSN to get the local weather. Had a 32-bit processor, ran at 27.6 megahertz, and half a mega RAM and about a third of a mega ROM. It was also used in the sideshow devices, which were put on TV remotes and on flash laptop bags, so you could check the check your emails without actually opening the bag. I'd never seen one. I found these pictures and went, oh. And then one of the other presenters had one. I thought, oh, cool. I've seen one at last. So the platform of choice for me, there are others, but it's the Netduino. And there are two manifestations of this. There's the Netduino and the Netduino Pro. This is the .NET equivalent of the Arduino. So if any of you have ever watched Make, where they talk about the Arduino, this is the .NET equivalent of it. It's got a 32-bit processor, ARM7, and the numbers and brackets are the amount of available RAM on the Pro platform. So Netduino, which runs the robot, 128K, woohoo. 64K for the pro with the network connection because you've got a TCP stack in there. And then your ROM, it's got 60K and 24K for the larger one. You've got plenty of I.O., though I've got one less on one of my boards after I had fat fingers. Some serial ports and pulse width outputs. So great thing about the PWM is you've got four, so you can actually control stepper motors and quite advanced pieces of kit. The 100 megabit LAN is good. You can act as both a client, and there are server packages for it. And how many of you have done WCF? There's actually an MF service util. So you can build a web service client which runs on one of these beasts. There are some reasons not to do this because the actual HTTP stack is the thick end of 20K. So that doesn't leave a lot of space for your apps, which can be pretty tragic. I've got to a situation in one app where I ended up writing my own HTTP client so I could chuck away all of the stuff I didn't need so that I could fit my app into the available memory space. Same with like NTP clients for getting the time. A lot of these devices don't have a real-time clock. So one of the first things you do is either talk to a piece of hardware plugged into the device or make an NTP call off to IRL. So how many of you here know about IRL's highly accurate clocks? If you want to set the time on your servers or set your time on your Netduino, IRL have a couple of really good network-connected atomic clocks, which I use for reference purposes. So we've got some demos now with my laptop and the document camera. So the first thing we'll do is we'll press 5. And then, so this is the most basic program that you will get for a device. This is the program that comes when you go file new. Basically, it flashes an LED on and off. So we'll just download that to the device. Oh, one of the other things that you want to consider is the MF deploy util. The MF deploy util is how you frag a device back to factory. When you've had an unfortunate outcome with your software, you do that. And now, bang, come on. We're now back to factory. This is a very useful util because I'm a fat-fingered typist. These devices, you've got to be careful because you haven't got a lot of bandwidth. You've got debug printout, which writes up the USB cable and is displayed on the output window of your laptop. That's great, but if you send too much data, it's too busy, and you can't get its attention when you want to do a breakpoint or anything like that. So it gets really quite awkward. So we'll build that and deploy it. Note the size of that, 30K. So we'll now go to the document camera. Press the button. This is the device. So we've downloaded our software and we'll now press the reset button. You'll see that the little red LED is flashing. That's the Netduino equivalent of the Fez Panda 2 equivalent of Hello World. It now gets more serious. I feel like I should be one of those Vietnam vets and blindfolded as I do this. This is to show how easy it is to connect additional input devices to the device. So we first unplug it. It would be bad to be slotting on stuff while the power is still connected. We then plug in the external flashing LED because we've covered up the one on the board. We'll plug the power back in. So we've got an external LED and a variable resistor. I won't flip back the monitors, but because it won't add a lot of value. And now we've deployed another app. We press the reset button, and you'll see this LED now flashes at a varying speed depending on the position of the volume control. This is like a marvelous education tool. If you ever want to sell robotics to kids, it's amazing how their eyes light up, funnily enough, when they see this LED flashing. There's lots of sensors available for this system. So, relays, passive infrared, ultrasonics, humidity, current, a joystick, a buzzer, some stuff, and an LED. If you get really, really serious, there's, can we see that okay? That's a GPS unit, and that little bit there is a compass with tilt, pitch, and roll. So you can buy this stuff across the internet. They'll ship it to you from China. And the great thing is, if you've got a product idea, you get them to ship you the bits, you build them, and then you ship your idea back and they make it into a product. And you've got a proof of concept and test harness to show how it all works, which is a good thing. You can debug your software. They've got buzzers, they've got beepers, they've got speakers, they've got Geiger counters, but there's not been any stock of those for quite a while. Every time they get some more, they get sold. So, next thing we're going to look at is some slightly more advanced sensors. So, we'll take that, put it out of the way. So, this is something a bit flasher. Got to find the power lead. Here we go. Just as we were starting the presentation up, the people came and saw me and said, oh, we can't find your presentation on the server. It's an old version. It's only draft. I'm thinking, I really don't need this right now. So, here we go. This is something a bit flasher. This, better turn it the right way up, is an accelerometer. Visualize the little accelerometer you have in your phone. It's got X, Y, and Z. And we've got some LEDs hitched to this board. Underneath is a Netduino, and you'll see as I move it around, the G values change, and the different lights come on, indicating whether it's an X acceleration, a Y acceleration, or a Z acceleration. On the bottom right of the display, you'll see the clock. This is the little RTC that I mentioned, a real-time clock. This device contains a crystal and a battery and keeps the time when the power is off. So this is the level that you can get to. These shields have lots of digital inputs and other accessories, and they're even stackable. So if you wanted your robot to tweet where it is as it drove around, there's a GSM modem. So you see on the back. So you can basically slide that on top. Robot, I'm backing up, going forward, turning left, turning right. Novelty would wear off fairly quickly. That's cool. So, flipping back to the laptop. So, we've done our demo. We'll now move on. So, Windows Azure. I've been doing Windows Azure since April 2010-ish, back in the days when there was an awful lot of DIY required. With the Internet of Things, it's really about connectivity. It's how you communicate with the back office. You've got issues around latency and jitter and round trips. If you're doing connectivity over GPRS from New Zealand, you can get anywhere between 200 and 1500 milliseconds delay, depending on who your ISP and the quality of your connection. Just simple things, like I've got an embedded device out in the field which is talking to Windows Azure. We save ourselves 200 milliseconds by doing basic auth and attaching the credentials to the request so that we don't have the additional round trip of the 401 challenge. You've got to think about things like that when you're building an Internet of Things application. You've got some different options. You've got sockets, HTTP, woohoo, the Azure storage APIs, queues, tables, and blobs, and then the Azure Service Bus. If you've got all of this data, you can use Stream Insight for analysis, and you've really got to focus on security because Azure is a long, whatever data center you choose, it's a long way from here. You're most probably going through some hostile networks, particularly if it's Wi-Fi. And one of the things that Azure is quite secure, but it makes it really hard. Some of these devices, like the Netduinos, don't have an HTTPS stack. So you end up rolling your own security, which is quite dangerous. And you have to focus a lot, because you haven't got a lot of CPU, on what bits of the message you actually secure. Do you need to encrypt the whole message, or can you just encrypt the relevant bit and ensure that you don't leak any useful details out via a side channel to an attacker? So this is an important thing. You've got to focus on how to secure it, taking into account the limitations of the device. Some of the flasher devices have got an HTTP stack with HTTPS, but you have to manually load your certificates and manually manage the revocation chains, which is a problem. So, everyone talks about scale-out with Wasabi. Yep, cool. It's an excellent thing. But, for example, with the Power Grid and EastEnders case, 5 minutes or 7 minutes, whatever it takes to spin up another roll, it's going to be too late. The lights are going to be out in Scunthorpe because you didn't have enough worker instances there ready to cope with the demand. It's a good thing. At some stage, I'd desperately like to be able to spin up instances close to instantaneously rather than after a quite substantial delay. So, sockets. This is very butch. There's a lot of DIY, but often it's the only choice. Sometimes you'll get an embedded device which will establish a connection to you, squawk a couple of bytes at you, and then hang up. And those bytes will be in whatever order the processor on the device is in. So suddenly you're having to deal with big endian, little endian, Motorola fast floating point, IEEE floating point, whatever it is, you're going to be doing it. It's a great thing to consider, but it's also bidirectional. You can both receive stuff and push stuff out to the devices if they are permanently maintaining a connection. Because of this, you've got to take a lot of care in doing it, and you'll spend a lot of time in the parallel programming team's blogs figuring out how to build your own version of Signal R. You've got to do a lot of stuff in the back office too. I worked with an embedded device which was running a Nix variety. To fit their Unix port onto the device, they hadn't included the DNS capability. They required us to have a static IP address for our Azure service, which was fine. There's some good articles by Chris Auld talking about how static your static IP might be. As long as I didn't delete the service, we would be okay. But if I did accidentally delete the service, it would cause me and my customer a world of pain. You need to think about how you set your DNS up as well, whether you require additional trips to the DNS host to resolve things because you don't want to slow stuff down. And you need to think about some of the settings in your CSF def file to allow your custom port to punch through the Windows load balancer. You need to think about how you cope with the load balancer, and if a connection breaks and is reestablished, the client may reattach to a different instance. So you need to manage state across those. You've got to look at the thread parallel libraries, and that's the only way you're going to get the required scale to cope with your application if it does need to scale massively. You've also got all of the security to do yourself. So good luck. Scope for disaster is high. There's a good chat about the cost of DIY cryptography in the Google Talks. The cost of DIY cryptography done wrong, it's roughly 5 to 10 times more expensive to prove the crypto is correct than it is to actually write it. So before you start DIYing crypto, think very, very carefully. So, HTTP, we're getting warmer. Lots of support and it's well understood. You can do push and you can pull, which is great. You've got some standard support, you've got XML, RPC, REST, and there are some slightly unnatural things you can do with REST to make it even more efficient in an Azure world, and I'll talk about those a bit later. Or SOAP. problem with SOAP is you've got a lot of overhead. And it's great inside your corporate firewall. Left click, well, I'm left-handed, so click the secondary selection button, add web reference, type in a URL, go. Excellent plan. Not so good on these devices, but it does work with MF Service Util. Making it scale is well documented and well understood, not that many people actually read the documentation, and you can scale out quite readily. The great thing is also the modem I held up before, that has baked in HTTP support. You can say, modem, execute a GET against this URL with this query string and tell me later what happened. And it can do GETs and POSTs and so forth. Security is well understood, though you may have some challenges in the level of security support available from the device. So if you're just doing HTTP, you need to think about whether you need tamper detection or privacy. If it's tamper detection, you can use a basic hash, and there are some small footprint device optimized ones. Or if you need privacy, there are SHA and a couple of other implementations available for the device. There's actually a plugin available for those if you've got a bit more RAM, which loads into the OS, which will give you all the crypto you need. So there's your storage APIs. You're getting a lot of scale here. Like a Azure queue will do 500 requests a second, and then you can go wide. It's both push and pull, though if you've got a million devices, having a million queues that the devices can poll and call to see if there's any message from them could rapidly turn into a bit of a logistical nightmare to manage. It's got a REST API, which is good. It means you can talk to it quite readily from one of these devices, and if you're willing to hand roll your own HTTP client, it won't consume much of your space. There's digital signatures. Oh, actually, HTTPS is also a selectable option for REST calls. So you can run without HTTP if you're confident that your data is not sensitive. Digital signatures. The Azure REST APIs, you have to digitally sign the payload and the headers. It's difficult, and it doesn't work the first time, and you'll scream and pull your hair out. What I did is sat down with a console app and a micro framework app, got the console app in Win32 working, and then cut, paste. Figured out what it broke, like the code used string.format. There's no string.format baked into the platform in the micro framework, so I replaced all the string.formats in .NET world, checked it still worked, and then cut and paste. And repeated this process until I had some code which I could cut and paste from one to the other, and it all worked most of the time. So, the Azure Service Bus. Not going to spend a lot of time here because other people have covered it in more than adequate detail. You need to think a lot about how you're going to partition your clients and how you recover after a catastrophic failure. And this is actually a consideration for all of the protocols. Say in the unlikely event that the whole of the town's power is turned off, when these devices come back up again, they will all try and talk to you, so you need to have an exponential back-off approach. You need to think about how you partition your clients across your servers so you don't run a denial of service attack against yourself as the clients restart, particularly if the clients have all got a GPS, which gives them super synchronized time down to the millisecond. It's a real problem, and some people have been badly stung by it. You can set up topics and clusters, and then you can broadcast out to the clients and filter what you broadcast to. There's some problems, though. Only works over HTTPS, so you've immediately limited your device choice. There's some additional complexity around the managing of tokens, and if you're going to be talking to ACS, you need to think about the billing ramifications, because you're going to be talking to ACS and you're going to be creating transactions, and suddenly your million devices are actually making a surprising amount of traffic. So you need to think about that. For example, you might want to cache your tokens for 30 minutes, a day, whatever. Just cache them so you're not continually going back to the ACS service. One of the other things you might end up doing is building a TCP/IP server which runs in a web role in front of the box, which then packages and forwards your requests to the Azure Service Bus. So I've just got to fire up the tools and we'll do the second demo. So this second demo is communicating with an Azure queue. So Sorry, I'm having a bit of a brain fade here. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, I had fat fingers. So you can now see my Azure Storage Queue application. I've got a device sitting on the keyboard here, on the document camera. We'll just download my software to that. So this is notice the massive increase in the size of the binary. It's gone from 30K, and now we've got some HTTP magic in there, and it's gone to 50K. These binaries can take a wee while to download, particularly the first time you download them. While it's doing its thing, I'll fire up another tool. So to view the glorious success that I'm about to have, I'll fire up Azure Storage Explorer from NewDesic. I'm actually running across a 3G connection here rather than connecting to the in-house LAN. So performance can be a bit of a suboptimal outcome. Cool. We've now downloaded something to the device. We'll look at the queues. Come on. And I know that my queue is 63. So we'll flip to the document camera. Press a button. And nothing happens. We'll reset the device. There we go. Green LED comes on. Green LED goes out. And if we refresh, there are 6 messages in the queue, and there are now 7. Oh, sorry. PC, red. Yeah, sorry. There we go. There are now 7 messages in the queue. We'll repeat that process so that you know I'm not having you on. And there are now 8 messages in the queue. Works pretty well, scales very well. These devices are great for this sort of thing. Visualize something which is harvesting data in the background and then uploading it as you go. So, this is the unapproved slide. I was trying to get this demo to work, and it wasn't. And it pained me. My wife went to bed and left my pajamas on the hall floor. It was a very bad scenario. It worked the first time, but it never worked again. I checked the timestamps. I checked the request versioning. The request versioning is quite sensitive. You need to be putting the right headers in so that it understands the message and doesn't toss its toys at you. I got a particularly helpful not authorized message. I checked that I was canonicalizing the message in the headers properly. I stared at this for ages. I was strongly considering siphoning 0.5 litre of petrol out of one of my cars and burning the NetDuino on my back lawn. I was over it. I started removing my debugging writes so I could figure out whether it was the debugging writes causing a problem. And one of the last debugging writes I went to remove was this one. And that's the 64-bit MIME-encoded digital signature. And right down at the very end here, there's a star. And that star is not a valid character. I only noticed it by accident. I went, oh. I had this flash of inspiration about 1 o'clock in the morning. I went, there's a star in there. And this gave me a clue to start searching. Turns out that the convert to base 64 method call in the micro framework chucks in some invalid characters, which you need to replace. Learn from my pain. Pajamas, hall floor, bad look, door shut. So, instrumentation and logging. You need to observe what's going on and hopefully before the wheels fall off, fix it. You don't have a lot of visibility into Azure with conventional tooling. So I tend to use things like Cerebrata Diagnostics Manager and the enterprise libraries. Some people bag the enterprise libraries, oh, the logging's not very good or the exception handle is not very good, but it's like a lot of products. Individually, the products are not the best, but rolled up into one, they're actually pretty damn useful. So I put in a lot of trace logging. I integrate with performance counters. Now, if you're doing performance counters, you need to create your category as the app starts if it doesn't exist. You also need to run in elevated privileges. Another pajamas hallway moment. Elevated equals true in the CSS FDIF file. So once you're up and running, you can log lots of stuff. You can draw some pretty graphs in Diagnostics Manager. And you can ensure you're meeting your customer SLAs. Because, of course, you will be selling this to make a fortune to give me a share of your IPO. So you've got to ensure that when the system fails, it comes back up gracefully as well by splitting your load and partitioning your customer base. So Signal R, this is the other part of the demo. I'm a real sucker for punishment. Signal R is a great way of broadcasting back to your user base what's going on in your Internet of Things application. It's a doddle to install unless you've had one of the beta versions and it was painful. But the great thing is, fire up NuGet, suck the binary down, compile, fix the compile error, it works. You can set up polling versus a persistent connection. It will fall back automagically depending on the capabilities of the device that you're using, which is great. I assume that IE6 will one day die and no one will come near my site with it. It's got broad platform support, so it works with the Forever window, it works on Firefox, it works on Chrome, and it works on Opera. It works on pretty much every platform you've got, and it will fall back to the lowest common denominator that your browser supports, which is great. It's got massive scale, tens of thousands of clients, and it's open source. Woohoo, can figure out how it works. Can step into it. I don't have to use Reflector to figure out how it works. So, bringing it all together, I'm from Christchurch. This has got an earthquake theme to it. There were some things that had been bugging me post the earthquakes. September the 4th, the first one, I was awake when it hit. And this bugged me. I worked in a distributed scrum team. We had people in Christchurch and the CBD and out by the beach in Auckland and in Sydney. One of my co-workers, Colin, had this marvellous podcaster microphone. I could hear earthquakes at his place. So if there was an earthquake out at sea, I heard it when we were having our Skype conversation, and then a couple of seconds later it got to me. If it was at my end, I felt it, and then a couple of seconds later I heard it hit at Colin's. It was quite disconcerting. My favourite coffee shop is a walk along the cycle path along the side of the railway tracks. And after every reasonably sized shake, an HRV or an LRV, I worked for Transrail at one stage, an HRV is one of the little Isuzu trucks, an LRV is one of the little Suzuki Jeeps, would go whizzing down the track and they'd jump out and they'd look at the bridge over and they'd look at the tunnel underneath and they'd look at the creek culvert and they'd check that everything was good. And then they'd go on. And they did this every time there was a quake. The novelty of that must have worn off after about the 20th time. I was having coffee at Elmwood Fine Foods on the 22nd. And the reason I was having coffee there was because a friend of mine's wife was going in for surgery at Southern Cross Hospital. And it did strike me at the time that being on the table would be a very bad thing. At EFF, there's a dentist next door, and I thought having a dentist in your mouth when an earthquake hit would be unpleasant enough. I was working on another team where I had a scrum team member in Tokyo. And he said, oh yeah, when there's a big shake comes through, the lift stops, we're on the nearest floor, and everyone gets out. They have a bit of warning. He also did say that in their tens of story building that people got seasick on the trading floor because the shaking went on so long. And that just freaked me out. I was looking at buying a house in Wanaka. I stumbled across this report and it was talking about the Alpine Fault. And they said every 300 years this will let go. There's a 25% chance of an 8.3 to an 8.6 in the next 50 years and a 50% chance in the next 100 years. So when that occurs, there will be 8-meter horizontal displacements, my, and 4-meter vertical displacements. And it will go on for many minutes. And this sort of put me off my lakefront section in Wanaka. So, seismology 101. I'll stroke my inner beard now. An earthquake consists of two sets of waves. There's a P wave and an S wave, a primary wave, a pressure wave, and an S wave, which is a secondary wave or a shear wave. They travel at roughly 2,000 to 4,000 meters a second, depending on what they're going through. The S waves travel at 60% of the speed of P waves. The P waves are usually a vertical jolt, bang. That's what woke me up on the September. And the S waves, which are the side-to-side bit, are what does the damage. So, distance travelled. Darfield is roughly 45 k's away from Christchurch. So you get 20 minutes warning. Arthur's Pass, 110 k's as the crow flies. So it's 65 seconds from when the P wave passes Arthur's Pass to where it gets to my house. Franz Josef, 195 k's. This is going to be Grand Central Station when the Alpine Fault lets go. There are buildings which span the Alpine Fault. The police station spans the Alpine Fault. Someone really wasn't thinking terribly carefully about that. So, Franz Josef, P wave. 95 seconds later, you will have something in Christchurch. So, locating a quake. By looking at the gap between the P wave and the S wave, in human terms, if you feel the P wave jolt and then start counting, it's 8 k's for every second between the two. So as a human, you could go, oh, that one's 32 k's away. So these are based on, say, a sensor at Arthur's Pass, a sensor at Wattaroa, and a sensor at Harry. You can work out by yourselves where the epicenter of my fake quake is. So, Quake Jour. It was a cool name. Commodity hardware for earthquake early warning. Spend a bit of time thinking about this, and it most probably won't work, but we'll give it a go. So, while I'm moving stuff out of the way here. So, you can buy this stuff from somewhere like Minekits up north. Netduino, $100. An accelerometer, $45. GPS, $105. You might not even need that. You could just use an NTP client, GPS antenna, $25. And a flex sensor. Where's the flex sensor gone? So, do any of you remember the Nintendo Power Glove? That's the sensor out of the Nintendo Power Glove. You flex it, and the resistance changes. Visualize if this was bolted to the pillars of the bridge that the Transrail people were looking at as they drove past. You can use proper strain gauges, proper deflection sensors. You can collect data from sensors like this and then upload it into the back office for post-processing. So they can say, oh yes, our bridge is still safe because we haven't exceeded our design tolerances for it. Simple things like this, $25. It's quite cool. Kids thought it was cool. So, software consists of two parts. There's P-wave detection and event notification, and then there's an S-wave recorder, which collects the data for the S-wave, bundles it up, and submits it to an Azure queue. I was going to have a flex sensor recorder, but I had to trim something to get some time. So, the Quake Jour client software and device. So here we go. This is the Quake Jour client. So, we've got the accelerometer, the real-time clock, and I won't touch it. Damn thing's so sensitive. My desk at home, my kids come running and go, Dad, what are you doing? Things are flashing. It's ending badly. So, this device is my earthquake detector. On my laptop, we won't look at some code, we'll just go straight back to the presentation. So, that's the Quake Jour client. It makes a REST call to a back office. There are some nasty things that you do to make your calls more efficient. rather than using streams to package up a request and a stream to analyze the response, what you can do is put the values in the headers. I know it's nasty, and if there are any Rastafarians out there, please don't hit me. It's a simple thing. I could go to all of the overhead of creating streams using to manage my streams, where I can just go headers dyad. It works. It's really simple. I like that. To misparaphrase George Bush, don't misunderestimate your own stupidity. I am at one with my inner idiot. So, Quake's your service. This is where I shoot myself badly in the foot. Failure is not an option. You need to do the queues for the inbound data. You need to use SQL for looking stuff up. I'm using Lightspeed underneath. You need to cache a lot of stuff because you don't want to have a SQL retry when your notification of something's coming in. If it's close, you've only got seconds. But if it's the HAST sensor triggered, you've got a minute and a half. Imagine how many lives a minute and a half could save before the main event arrives. It's enough time to drape a cloth over someone having surgery. If you're really determined, it's enough time to get out of the building. I've got a web role which handles the inbound events, and then I've got some software which analyzes those inbound events and works out whether it's something of substance. There's a UI, and when you see the UI, you'll understand that I am an engineer, which provides for the display of the events from a client. So, I've got sensors at HAST, and you want to think about how you're going to manage this. You want sensors up close because they will get the warning out early, and you want sensors further away, which will collect the data and send it in as you're waiting. So, visualize these inside cell sites or ADSL boxes or things like that in the field where you can have reliable power and a reliable connectivity. It's not a lot of load. You're only going to be squawking out a few bytes every so often. And if you have enough of these devices, the message will definitely get through. So let's take my life in my own hands. Laptop, red button. Engineer UI. It sent it. Oh, no. So, in a perfect world, what would have happened is the HAST township would have flashed red. It's actually uploading it and sending it because I can see the traffic. I'll just try a different browser. I've been struggling with connectivity here for the last while. I'm shattered. So what would happen was HAST Township would flash red, everyone would take heed of the warning and sprint for cover. Damn. So you can see it's basically sending them here. We'll flip back to the slides. So, summary. Just had to do it to me. What did we learn today? Great thing about this kit is it just inspires ideas. You sit down and you play with it, and the kids like it. You build stuff, you learn stuff. It's plug and play. It's a great platform for data acquisition, but there's always there's always considerations around connectivity. Windows Azure is a great platform for data aggregation and analysis. The connectivity is good, but there are some challenges around that with HTTPS and so forth. Scalability is baked into the platform, and it's the only way you're going to get a business with global scale from a laptop. So, some questions, please.
So, have you thought about putting this out on some of the public funding sites, getting open source funding to actually take it to the next step?
Well, I'd give it away.
Fair enough, but I mean, if you make that part of the open sourcing, there's three or four different platforms right now. People can raise them. Heck, now Bowman just got himself a Tesla museum. Make it open source. It's not for you to make a business off, but just for museum as all.
So in the States, they have the QC and the Quake Catcher Network. It's mainly designed for post-processing, whereas this is more intended for notification. I can see why it died, the modem to reset itself. This is what my connectivity was. I was tempting fate just a little bit. Telecom, T-Stick. Sorry, telecom people. For some reason, I can't even get a balance off that bloody thing. I was worried I was going to run out of credit as it was running. So, gentlemen. There you go. Build yourself a rug.
Really, I think it's worthwhile, especially, in Japan, they've got the system, they built it by the people. They stopped the high-speed train. Exactly the same technology. P-waves come through, high-speed train stops, plenty of time for the damage to come along. You've got something that can be built fairly cheaply, that can be easily open source, and we can probably get this placed out for the community.
Yep.
And I think it'd be worthwhile trying to pursue.
Imagine if part of the mandate for putting an ADSL cabinet or a cell site in was to
throw one of those in.
My software is pants. It was designed just to illustrate the fact. It was something I built, but I spent a bit of time understanding it. So if anyone's interested, drop me a line. I'll show you, talk it through with you. The guys from MindKits were great, giving me a robot to give away. You should be able to bolt that together with $100 worth of parts, $80 worth of parts, and have it navigate around the floor.
And a few bathrooms on the floor outside the bedroom.
Yeah, you don't want to go there. It's not a happy place. So, any more questions, team?
Have you talked to Bob Parker about
this? No. It's something I built one evening.
A couple of years.
So, a ticket for TechEd is what, $1,800? I'm well behind at my standard charge out rate. So, yeah, there is some scope for this. If you have a permanent wired connection rather than that, you will end up in a happier place. These sensors come in hard drives. Visualize a series of sands in a data center. You've got a dirty great big earthquake detection and capture array. Say you've got 1,000 hard drives. That's 1,000 of those sensors doing their thing, monitoring what's going past the data center. That gives you both direction and speed. It's very cool. Gentlemen in the poop.
Yeah.
It's relatively simple. I could get that past the finance committee at home. Until there was the late nights and so forth. So, thank you very much for your time. I hope you enjoyed my presentation. I did four demos.